When it comes to cleaning your house, who doesn't wish un galán with a trust fund swept in and passed the mop to your evil stepmom like in the telenovelas? Hola, it's Chiquis here, and although life isn't always like in the soap operas, Fabuloso does bring a clean that's always over the top. Get your home dramatically clean anytime you like without any evil mama drama. Just long-lasting lavender freshness. That's Fabuloso, taking the drama out of any mess.
Fabuloso's 2x concentrated formula provides 2x more active ingredients versus non-concentrated Fabuloso original. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. Holy cow, you guys. Do I have a good one for you today? A really juicy, memorable ghost story. I stumbled across it, actually, during my investigation into the different ghost hunting equipment, cameras, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. I think that's a sign from the universe to share it with everyone and get it out of my own head. Today, we are doing a spotlight episode of the still relatively unknown story of the Glassell Park Haunting, a.k.a. the Polaroid Ghost, a.k.a. the Ghost Rider. Spotlight episodes are hyper-focused episodes we spend looking at just one story or occurrence that I feel are above and beyond in some ways. I think the last spotlight I did was on the Lake and Heath Bentwaters UFO case, which was absolutely incredible, just jaw-dropping stuff, and not talked about nearly enough. I think the same can be said for today's story. Some of you may have been introduced to this story in the last couple of years if you watched the Surviving Death series on Netflix. But prior to that, if you had heard about it, you probably either caught it on Sightings in the early 90s or the show Fact or Faked over a decade ago. This is a story that is hard to believe at first, yet hard to deny by the time you are finished with it. We'll see how you guys are feeling on the other end. It comes with a lot of photo evidence, some of which my YouTube audience is going to get to see as we go through it, multiple witnesses, failed attempts to debunk, and the unwavering testimony of the two men at the center of it who experienced this haunting firsthand, who maintain that the phenomenon they began to document in the early 1990s was real and continues to this day. Now, before we begin, regarding that ghost hunting equipment episode, I asked during that show for folks' personal go-to tools while investigating, in return for a shout-out for you and your group, and I got a couple to share with you guys. Michael says a recorder, pin, paper, and camera work best for him. Same, Mike, same. I'm trying to keep it nice and simple over here, you know? Michael does not have a regular investigating group, but he does have a new paranormal podcast releasing in January. Look for Hangar 22 on all podcast platforms. The amazing recommendation for a DVR system to keep an eye on all y'all's cameras comes from Jason at Lost Souls Paranormal Detectives out of Knoxville, Tennessee. Jason, you already know it. You're such good people, man. I already mentioned Jason's suggestion during that episode, but it bears repeating. Think smarter, not harder. Damien, from the husband and wife team Soulmates Beyond the Veil, says other than his senses and feelings, his go-tos are the REM pod, due to so much prior intelligent interactions he's had with it, a voice recorder, because you are more likely going to capture audio over video evidence, and the spirit box. He thoroughly enjoys using this when conducting Estes sessions. Says the answers don't always make sense. But when they do, it's a holy fuck moment. I couldn't agree more, Deboos. Thank you guys so much for your suggestions. Happy investigating! All right, I was also planning to do a quick recap of my Halloween investigation at St. Ignatius Hospital, but unfortunately, we have not completed our evidence review on our end just yet. Hoping to have that soon for you, though. So, let's get into this ghostwriting business. The first time John Huckert stepped foot inside John Matkowski's and soon to be his home, he felt something strange. Heavy, he says. He would ask Matkowski if his house was haunted. Matkowski would say, no, and then proceed to give examples of just how haunted it was. The roommate prior to Huckert had complained early on of an unsettling atmosphere and hearing things, strange things, like footsteps on the roof. Members of visiting family had also mentioned footsteps. Huckert was logical about it at first, imagined it was no more than critters making all that racket up there. His initial sense of a haunting would be confirmed after moving in, though. He would report feeling a presence. He'd feel what felt like a hand on his shoulder, only to turn to find no one there. There were moving shadows that quickly disappeared, and then there were the people he would see. An old man standing in their living room disappeared as soon as he turned to look. A woman in an old-looking dress walking by the street or on their porch. Thinking she was real, he would go to check. Once again, no one to be found. Even Matkowski, as well as he had learned to ignore the weirdness, would report in those early days a tingling on his arms, almost like a sunburn. And that's how he felt the presence. A couple of years came and went, the strangeness ongoing. Then in 1991, Huckert would be gifted a Polaroid camera by his father for Christmas. A Spectra camera, which Polaroid no longer makes. Even had some film left in it, which is great, because film for this thing was really expensive. Approximately $1 per picture. They came in sleeves of 10. In March of the following year, Huckert says he was sitting at the dining room table working on a writing project when the bathroom door swung open, and he was overcome by an especially strong sense of something, a presence. At the time, Huckert was alone in the house. Perhaps it was a spidey sense to do so. Maybe it was a photography enthusiast's impulse, but he picked up his Polaroid camera, aimed it at the bathroom entrance, and snapped a picture. Considering how expensive this film was back then, I'm willing to bet it was more so an undeniable spidey sense of just not being alone. I don't know. The pic popped out, developed, and nothing but the bathroom entrance and the shot. Maybe it had just been open the entire time and I didn't realize it, he thought. Feeling rather stupid and silly, he got up, closed the bathroom door, and returned to the dining room table to continue writing. Not too long after sitting back down, he heard the familiar scrape the bathroom door made against the hallway floor. He looked up to catch it finishing its swing back open. The presence was definitely there. This was a sign to take another photo. Now nervous and shaking, he pointed the camera and attempted another shot, capturing the top of their television set by accident. This is ridiculous. Calm down, he thought to himself. Steeling himself against the nerves, he leveled the camera at the entrance once more, snapped the photo, and captured the first ever photograph of their third roommate. Huckert says his first feelings when staring at the developed picture were ones of fear, but also maybe amusement. He thought on one hand it was absolutely terrifying to be looking at what he had captured, but on the other, it was rather comical looking. It was a stereotypical ghost for my audio-only audience. Remember the hypothetical I asked you in the season's history episode? If I asked you to draw me a picture of a ghost, what would that look like? Well, Huckard's picture was that. Like, ooh, I'm a ghost. You know, kind of ghost. All right, look, I'll be honest. At this point of my very first look at the story, I stared at my computer screen for a second and was like, well, that's some pretty strange bullshit right there. Now, I don't feel that way. I even have a theory as to why this entity chose to portray itself as such. But, you know, here we are. Huckert thinking the same thing. And also, though, like, what the heck is that? What did I capture? So he took another, and the boo ghost was closer. He would take a few shots, each time getting something weird, white, and splotchy in the photo. You know, what was going on? When Makowski returned home, Huckert showed him the photos, asking him what he thought about them. Makowski thought, these are kind of cool, and asked him how he had done them. And Huckert told him, I don't know, dude. I just pointed and clicked. Makowski would direct Huckert to stand in front of the bathroom door as he took a photo. Yet another strange capture. Huckert is seen standing in the photo with these white, splotchy, misty, dare I say, ectoplasmic-like things in front of him. They would continue shooting until the pics that had been left in the camera ran out. Now keep in mind, at this point in the story, all they were getting on the photos were some strangely shaped light anomalies on film. They were weird, yeah. One definitely looked like a boo ghost, but it had to be explainable. Had to be fake. Huckert had a realization. His dad, who had given the camera to him, was kind of a prankster. He thought, you know, he had to have done something to the camera. He had to have done something to that film. That's what this was. Well, 2 weeks later, just to prove a point, I guess, they would pick up another pack of Spectra film and decided, you know, just in case this is something, let's just shoot whenever we feel something. And by the very next time they used the camera, they answered the question of whether it was Huckard's dad or not, because it happened again. And they would continue to buy new packs of film. And time again, they kept getting these weird shots. So they kept buying more film. The cycle would continue over the next couple of months. Finally, they decided, you know, it might be time to share it with someone outside of this house. But they both have said they feared ridicule or, like, accusations of being liars. So they decided to just invite a few friends over, just to show them. They prepped these friends much like Huckert prepped Makowski. So, hey, this is weird, but we caught this on film. What do you think? And the friends looked and were like, oh, this is kind of cool. How did you do this? And they were like, we don't know. We just kind of took the picture and this stuff keeps showing up. There must have been some kind of ghost talk in there somewhere. You know what I actually think? I suspect Makowski's place was, like, notorious for being, like, a ghost house to their whole circle of friends, like, being the haunted house. So, yeah, whatever. Ghost talk was happening, because then one of the friends asked, well, are they here now? And another one said, well, let's see. Picks up camera, takes photo, and this was the moment. They would capture their third roommate's first communication. Y-E-S. Yes, they were there now. The Johns said it took them a second to see the word. Understandable. I am going to put it up on screen now, but yeah, if you are not looking for it, you might miss it for a second. But then, bam, there it is. Clearly a word written in white, smoky pen. So, once they realized they had an intelligent response in their hot little hands, this opened the floodgates. Someone asked, what's your name? Snap, picture develops. W-R-I-G-H-T. Right. like a last name. Or maybe it was a direction for someone to start auto-writing, and this whole story would be so much shorter because they would have figured it all out by now. But they assumed it was a name, and so the ghost was like, well, I guess my name is right now. Thanks, land of the living, you dum-dums. Anyway, they all went with the last name. So then someone asked, are you a good ghost or a bad ghost? Snap. Picture develops. F-R-I-E-N-D. Friend. At this point, they had three back-to-back intelligent, clear communications from something they could not see unless they aimed this camera at it. The Johns said this experience changed everything. Huckert's belief in ghosts at this time was not inspiring. He thought ghosts were nothing but residual energy, like all of them, non-intelligent, just loops of film playing on a space-time movie screen. Because he's a filmmaker, so that reference does make sense. Anyway, that changed this night. They realized what they had was something special and something intelligently responding to them. Now, this new communication would continue. Not every time they snapped a photo, of course, but regularly enough, they were holding this consistent communication with the ghost of their home. Once they had the last name of Wright and had experienced enough of these communications to realize something really wacky but awesome was definitely taking place, Matkowski wanted to dig a little deeper into the mystery of who this Wright was. The Johns would visit the Los Angeles City Hall and would actually uncover a few connections. They would discover a few people named Wright in their area of Southern California. But only one guy named Wright, who literally owned the whole mountain area of where their house was situated. I don't know. Don't want to put the cart before the horse or anything, but, you know, it's probably him. I would have assumed so. All this while, them doing research on the property, continuing on with their ghost photography, they were getting communications. And all the while, and this can be documented when you look at these pictures in chronological order, but Wright was clearly honing and refining his writing skills, each time producing something just a bit more clear, a bit more refined, a bit more poetic and philosophical. And while early communications took place in English, latter communications began appearing in Latin. That's pretty educated, pretty fancy. That says to me, maybe the ghost is a lawyer, maybe a doctor. I mean, I think they have to learn Latin as well, I believe, some. For full transparency's sake of this story, the Johns would either obtain or already did own a Latin dictionary. This fact does not deter me, and I'm hoping you will see why before the story is over. But yes, they did. As we see from video documentation of the case later on, they refer to it in order to translate what Wright is trying to communicate to them. They were writers in Hollywood. They had like a whole library of books in their house. I own two Italian dictionaries. Dudes, does that mean I know how to speak it? No. It's nice when I need it for reference, though. All right, so an example of one of these Latin-based responses is in answer to the question, did you die in this house? This seems like a pretty regular question to ask a ghost on investigation, right? The answer, inter alia corpus delicti, meaning, among other things, a murder victim. I do wonder what the among other things means. Like, maybe he lived and did a crap ton of stuff within the house, and then he's like, but among other things, you know, I was murdered. I don't know. I'm not sure. On another occasion, the Johns, both experiencing writer's block, needing some inspiration, perhaps, posed some question to that extent and received back, in English, invoke muse. They interpreted this as a nudge to overcome the block and to keep going. So Wright had a very inspiring side, as well as a, like, you know, I'm from the streets, yo, I was murdered here son, you know, side. Anywho, after the visit to City Hall for property records, after further contact with Wright and undeniable activity, John Makowski wanted clarification on what was going on. He wanted some answers, an explanation. He had been watching this little show in the 90s called Sightings. Anyone familiar? I saw it. Sightings covered all kinds of paranormal, supernatural, UFO, spiritual, what have you, subjects. John must have thought they were good and thought, well, they have this investigative team. I must send them some pictures, see if we can't get them out here to investigate. The sightings people would say yes, because how can you not with that first picture of a boo ghost, right? That's just good TV right there. Anyway, they came with Carrie Gaynor, parapsychologist leading up the investigation, a skeptical special effects / photography expert named Edson Williams, a crew to the Johns home. They brought with them 4 of their own Spectra cameras and a box of fresh, factory-sealed film, marked, numbered, and logged. The sightings episode says they also had 2 people guarding the film, 1 to load and 1 to watch everything. Now, why have I mentioned Spectra film a couple of times during this episode? Why is Spectra film important to this specific story? Because it was found through gatherings and Halloween parties held at the Johns home, where friends and acquaintances who decided to bring their own Spectra cameras, but other kinds as well, only Spectra was capturing this anomalous communication. Only Spectra. And as I said, Spectra is no longer made. They discontinued it in 2008. There was a group called the Impossible Project that partnered with Polaroid to try to start its production up again after that, but it doesn't seem like it lasted that long. Anyway, Sightings shows up with their own equipment, own film. Huckert says that every time the Sightings crew came to their house, communication via Polaroid was captured. During the episode, you can watch this happening on film. They leave the video camera running on the Polaroid, snapping a photo, dispensing the photo, and the photo developing, revealing some weird anomalies right there in real time on camera. The sightings crew was shocked, to say the least. They would even tell the Johns off camera they rarely got anything real like this, something that was actually like real evidence. During this episode, 3 important things would happen. Sightings would contact Polaroid, like the corporation, and would speak with Howard Warzel, a photography expert who was skeptical, but kind of at a loss as to how this phenomenon was taking place. He would say, after 50 years of Polaroid selling film to billions of customers, including a much higher sensitivity film than the Spectra that the Johns were using, he had never encountered anything like this. When he put forth that his skepticism would be eliminated if the film came from Polaroid in a sealed box without the seal having been broken, he was shown that non-cut video that Sightings had shot of the loading of a factory-sealed pack into the Johns camera, the shooting, the developing, and the revealing of the anomaly. So, maybe his skepticism was alleviated at that point. Maybe not. I don't know. What's that quote? For the believer, no amount of proof is necessary. For the skeptic, no amount of proof is, like, enough. I don't know. Something along those lines. The second really important thing to take place was the Wright photo's first attempted debunking. Edson Williams, again, photography special effects expert, was on site during the filming. He was there to examine photos immediately and inspect them to evaluate whether or not they were authentic or had been manipulated. Even one in which he is captured in the background behind the light anomaly that he would say later made him feel like something weird might be in the house. Anyway, during this investigation, Edson would travel back to the Brooks Institute along with the Johns' own camera, even though other photos were captured on other cameras, and all exposed film in order to more closely examine and attempt to explain how the photos were being produced. and he would come up with an explanation, a way the Johns might be perpetrating this hoax. Step one, shoot pieces of white cotton that have been formed into a string of letters on a blank surface with a 4x5 camera using E6 film. You are creating a transparency with nothing but the word on it. Step two, pre-expose the Polaroid film with that word by removing the cover sheet from the Polaroid pack, insert the transparency sheet with the cotton text they just shot, and use a flash pack or light to expose the Polaroid. Step three, remove that transparency with the picture of the cotton text and replace it once again with the regular cover sheet. Step four, load the pack of photos into your camera like normal and shoot. That first photo you take will have the word written over your image because it's already been exposed. This process took Edson over an hour to do. And as we can see from the sightings episode and other video documentation of the Wright communications, the actual process is happening like so fast, like kind of instantly. There is also something about Wright's text that I will bring up later that is another important factor to consider, and that is 3D dimension and depth of Wright's Polaroids versus all other text that has been produced during debunking attempts. The third and final really important thing to happen during this investigation was the introduction of the Johns to famed psychic medium at the time, Peter James. Peter and the Johns would end up becoming very good friends following this experience, and he would actually be the one to suggest to the Johns that they go public with their story. The three remained in contact with Peter until his death in 2007.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Now, Peter would be brought in during the second half of the sightings investigation to pick up on any energies that he felt. He was not front-loaded, was told nothing about the property, the house, or any other information aside from there was a claimed ghost and it was communicating via Polaroid. Now, while Peter was a famous psychic, was known for his readings and investigations at other well-known cases and properties, he was also known to have debunked a few. And Peter would say when he first approached this case, he was skeptical, thought there was fishery afoot. He said during the episode that in all his years delving into the paranormal, he just never had seen a ghost present itself in this way. But that all things are possible. And perhaps this was just something new that he had just never encountered before. So, you know, skeptical, on the fence, this would not last long. However, pretty quickly into his initial walkthrough of the house, Peter picked up on strong emotions. He talked about a vibration, feeling like he was vibrating. He could feel cold spots, picked up on a presence, a few presences, actually. He would stop in one specific spot in front of the bathroom door entrance and say, "I feel a very strong vibration. Something is definitely coming up from the floor. I get a tingling sensation. It's also very cold here. My legs are trembling. It feels like something is coming from below, and it's going through my entire body." He would describe it feeling like he was standing on a foot massager, and the feeling of energy coursing upwards through him to the ceiling. Matkowski would snap off a couple pics of Peter at this point, and lo and behold, strange ectoplasmic images appeared to surround him while standing over this spot that Peter would term the spiritual vortex. He believed that was where all of the spirits were entering and exiting. During this walkthrough, Peter would also mention several names he was picking up. Gilbert, John, Stephen, Robert, Ramon, Evelyn, Amelia. The Johns were dumbstruck because Peter had just named three people that they had jotted down as prevalent names during the property's history that they had discovered during their trip to City Hall. They had not told anyone, let alone Peter, any of this prior to his walkthrough. Gilbert, Robert, and Amelia were all direct hits. I can understand Robert as maybe a lucky guess, but Gilbert and Amelia? Pretty unique names, right? Peter would say, while these three names were those of spirits more regularly there, none of them were those of the ghost rider. Interestingly, in a later interview, Huckert would mention that they had come to feel, for whatever reason, that Wright was a male presence, and also they thought his name was John. Perhaps that is the first name of the Wright who they discovered owned the land. If so, that would mean Peter actually hit on four names without realizing it. On that note, though, another possible name had surfaced for Wright. A mother and daughter who were visiting at one point noticed in the Wright photo that says his name, something had been overlooked. The appearance of lettering just above where Wright is written. They thought it looked like Jake, maybe? I don't know. Could be. I see something there. I'm just not sure what that is. Now, like I said before, Peter and the Johns would actually become friends following this episode, and Peter would visit the house numerous times, always picking up on something. He would say there was a small handful of spirits who were there on the property most of the time, and a bunch who were in and out through the vortex. At one point, he picked up on the spirit of a Native American whose tribe had been local to the area and had used the land that the house now sat on as a ceremonial center. Well, later on, the Johns would decide to investigate this claim. They began to dig small test holes on the property and would discover shards of pottery that appeared to be Native American in origin. This would be examined by an archaeologist at the Southwest Museum who found the pieces valid and significant enough to warrant a much larger dig, and in all likelihood, yeah, this area could have been used for ceremonies. Another spirit he described was that of a man who had been murdered, and that could be who was buried under the house, right where the vortex was located. Peter would throw out a few things about this impression of a body and a murder a couple of times. At a Halloween party later that year, he would say, "Robert tells me he knows who is buried." So it's a little unclear to me who is actually under there or who is believed to be under there, but with all of the confirmation that the Johns received from Peter's readings, they felt certain there was indeed someone's grave beneath their feet. The reality of digging for it was just never possible. It would require moving the house, so that would never come to be. Though, when the team at the show Fact or Faked would come to investigate, they sent a couple of guys down there into the crawl space. They would discover bones there on the surface, which should tell you, you know, right away, yeah, that's probably not what Peter is talking about. And it wasn't. It was like cow and chicken bones, I believe. If someone had been murdered and then buried to hide the body, that's not just going to be sitting on the surface like, hey, it's going to be deep, you know, maybe in a rug. If you know, you know. The Johns need to get some sniffer dogs, is what I'm saying, and then make a TikTok about it. Ruggate 2.0. So, no body to date, no digging in the foreseeable future, but the Johns still have no doubt that someone is down there. One more of Peter's impressions that I would like to talk about is regarding the spirit of Amelia. He seemed especially focused on her and would say that she was the strongest spirit on the property. He would describe her as the longest-lasting, longest-existing spirit to reside there. She had the ability to wander pretty much anywhere, wasn't confined to a single spot. She was incredibly sad, and he could sense her sobbing. She only hung around because she was waiting for her husband to return. She was heartbroken that he hadn't. It was suggested that Amelia might have been the woman in the old-timey dress that Huckard had seen wandering the property so many times. And this was not just in Huckard's mind. It's reported that one day the neighbor asked Metkowski about a woman in a dress running through his backyard and asked if he had seen her too. He had not. The sightings episode would originally air February 5th of 1993. John Metkowski would later say that after all was said and done, aside from becoming friends with Peter, this experience left a bad taste in his mouth. He felt wronged and used by the sightings producers. When he originally reached out to them, it was because he was looking for answers. He sincerely wanted to figure out what was happening in his house. But as soon as sightings got what they wanted from them, nabbed their evidence, aired the program, no one reached back out to try and actually help him. No one but Peter wanted to help find answers for this mystery. That being said, let's take stock of where we are at in this story. The Johns don't understand what's going on, but something weird is happening. Friends have been by, taken their own pictures with their own spectra cameras, and caught their own strange, anomalous images. During the 93 Halloween party, actually, a few pictures were snapped on a friend's camera of Metkowski in his costume that came back anomalous. I will put those up. Peter's skepticism was obliterated the moment he stepped foot in the house. The entire team of sightings was astonished and left scratching their heads. Carrie Gaynor, who reported on the investigation, had been in the parapsychology field for 20 years, was quite familiar with the literature, said he had never seen anything like this in his experience or in the literature, that it could really only be explained in one of two ways. Either it was an example of psychokinetic powers from the Johns, who in a sense were imprinting their own thoughts onto the film, or there was a ghost who had figured out how to manipulate the camera or film to communicate. Polaroid was astonished and left scratching their heads. And one debunking attempt had been made and was laughable. It just clearly wasn't how the hoax was being done, if there was a hoax being done. Another attempt to debunk would be made in the fall of 93, reported on by Anson Kennedy for Skeptical Inquirer. It is argued in this article that the credibility of the belief that you can't fake a Polaroid is undeserved. And you can, in fact, fake a Polaroid. It just has to be done beforehand. Which is what Edson Williams and the sightings episode showed as well, so I'm not sure why this argument is being promoted as a new concept. They aren't wrong. That is exactly how a Polaroid would be faked. They then argue that Edson's process of manipulating the film was intentionally done to appear so overcomplicated that no dunce, no layman, could possibly recreate the process. And go on to write that actually, no, this process is so easy, anyone with access to a photo lab and some photographic know-how can do it. And then proceed to tell the reader this much easier process they conducted on their end that was exactly the same thing Edson had done. Create the transparency, expose the film, swap out for the cover sheet, glue up the pack so it appears to be signed, sealed, and delivered straight from Polaroid's headquarters. A new consideration they do introduce, though, is the fact this doesn't just have to be done with the top Polaroid. It can be done with different Polaroids throughout the pack to make the capture seem, you know, a little more random. They do also mention the fact that at the time, one of the Johns worked in a photo processing lab and therefore had the access and know-how to produce the effect. Actually, they were both into photography. This was no secret. And probably, I have to assume the Inquirer is referring to John Huckard. That may be why his father gifted him a Polaroid camera for Christmas in the first place. But maybe it was Metkowski who would present the right photos in an exhibit at his art gallery in 2007. He was more so into black and white photography. But bottom line, guilty by association, I guess. The film used during the sightings episode was brought by the sightings team. A box of it, all of which were factory sealed, numbered, logged, guarded, etc. To say all one has to do is carefully peel the bottom flap open, conduct your hoax, and then glue it back up is saying the entire sightings team was in on it, along with the Johns, of course, along with all of their friends who must have been frequenting the same photo lab in order to also acquire the desired effect. This also does heck all to explain the intelligent communication happening on the spot, direct answers to direct questions being asked by literally anyone in the room prior to snapping the photo. Lucky guesses on both John's parts, you know? Maybe they weren't psychokinetically gifted, but rather premonitorily gifted. And while it doesn't seem that the original printed Inquirer article is available anywhere, I can only find it in TXT format, so it's missing their pictures taken of their faked Polaroids, the way it has been described matches the descriptions of every other attempt to fake these types of photos. The text is flat, rigid. Wright's communications are flowy, misty, amorphous. They have a three-dimensional appearance to them. They appear to have depth in the space of the room, some of which both appears in front of a body and simultaneously behind a body in the same picture. This article does introduce a lot of important considerations to this story, but, I mean, come on, don't claim a debunking. Say case closed, cut and dried, when it's just not. It's just not. The team at Faked or Fact, who went to investigate and would claim at the end of it that they too could not explain, attempted their own faked photos. Same text depth problem, same time problem. It took forever to create the effect. Another known attempt at debunking took place with Michael Weber, one of the best close-up magicians in the world at the time. From a ghosttheory.com article dated April 1st, 2008, after the sightings investigation, Michael claimed that he could duplicate the ghostwriting phenomenon. In a closed studio in the presence of sightings host Tim White and a camera crew, Weber was able to produce a photo with the words, "We are here," printed across the front. However, Weber was quick to point out that his ability to duplicate the ghostwriting did not disprove that it could have been caused by supernatural forces. It only proved that the same phenomenon could be reproduced under similar conditions. Very true. No one's arguing that they can't. But descriptions of his faked photos have the same too rigid, no depth issues. No one to date has been able to produce the same dimensional effect seen in the right photographs. The article continues. Weber reviewed the videotapes shot inside the house and said he did not notice any of the trademark movements called tells that would have indicated that either Metkowski or Huckert was a professional magician. And I assume he's referring to sleight of hand tells in regards to either of the Johns quickly sneaking in their manipulated photo packs with the packs brought by the sightings crew. Javier at ghosttheory.com would actually follow up with John Metkowski again in 2009. It's a really great conversation, a great look into Metkowski, puts him in just like a real authentic light, I thought. He would tell Javier some new information about these years that I hadn't seen noted on any other sources. Since we're still on the skeptic argument of today's show, I will share with you something he had to say about that that just really chaps my cheeks, dudes. just chaps them real good. Keep in mind, all of these skeptics and debunkers would come out of the woodwork to immediately claim hoaxery, fakery, write up their articles, tout their technical knowledge of how it was all actually faked, etc., etc. John said none of them, save Joe Nickel, reached out to him to ask to come investigate in person. Do y'all believe that? That, my friends, is not ethical skepticism. John's quoted as saying, "I would have loved if any one of those skeptics would have come in and did their investigation." But they didn't. As for Joe Nickel, John said he only reached out to come investigate after the Skeptical Inquirer article was published, after they had already told the world that Matkowski and Huckert were hoaxers, when they hadn't even been there, seen it for themselves. So at that point, Matkowski said, no. I mean, you know, do you blame him? I certainly don't. Matkowski also shared with Javier his belief that Wright, whoever or whatever the spirit was looking out, was a guardian of sorts. Not only had Wright communicated via Polaroid that he was there for him and Huckert when asked, "Why are you here?" he responded, "I am here for you." When asked, "Are you here for us or the house?" the response, "Genius loci," appeared. Latin for pervading or guardian spirit of a man or place. Wright implied in other photos numerous times in one way or another that he was there to inspire them and to watch over them. And based on some observations by Matkowski, I don't doubt it. John told Javier that on two separate occasions, he had witnessed something having caught fire that could have ended up quite a bit more severe. One had to do with dry pine needles catching fire on the roof, and another time, extension cords like got too hot inside the house. He saw both times as these potentially serious fires somehow mysteriously extinguished themselves. The extension cords seemed to grow legs, move, and then fall into a container of water. Lucky break. Another time, he says that during a really bad, dark time in his life, he was dealing with personal stuff, and it sounds like he was just really struggling. I mean, we've all been there. It is the worst. Well, he had just finished a shower, gets out, and notices the word "don't" written in the fog of the mirror. He says the strange thing was that it was written backwards, as if by someone on the opposite side of the reflection. Don't. The Johns don't communicate with Wright as often, of course, without the same spectra access that they had before. One source I found said that Matkowski claimed that some communications have been established via digital formats. I have not seen any evidence of that, and most other sources say no, the literal writing communication ended with the demise of Spectra. I don't know if it was attempted again with the Impossible Project's launch. But again, I haven't a clue if their chemistry for the film was even, you know, the same, or if it was different, or what made the original Spectra special in this story. Whatever the case, they say they know he's still around. They said that after years of living with Wright, the two have become far more philosophical about things. He has helped them carry on when they had writer's block, felt burnt out, felt like quitting. I spent my life in the arts and 10 years in Hollywood. I get it. Totally understand the need for that push. I would have loved to have had a Wright in my life. He has told them some really interesting things about himself, things we might ponder as far as being a ghost is concerned. When they asked where he goes when he's not there, he answered, "Flux." neither here nor there. Just flux. Interesting. When they ask, "Who are you really? Tell me in words I can understand." His response? God's light. A really interesting one, not sure what I think about it, but when they asked him what the most difficult thing was for him to do, he said, "Time travel." It's time travel time, baby! Shout out to my Black Cat Report boys. Everyone, go catch their three-part episodes on Kyuchi, Tsuruhiko Kyuchi. It was bomb. Trust. So good. Joe Augustine, a friend of Huckert and Matkowski, had spent a lot of time at the house, taking notes, getting copies of the photos, and he would go on to write a book about this case and story. Seems like he took Wright's advice. The Johns had asked Wright at one time if they were ever to tell this story, you know, put it in a book, what should they call it? Ghostwriter was the response. And that is what Augustine titled his book. You know, though, I feel the need to end this one on Wright's answers regarding the universe and the beyond. I just think they're perfect and beautiful. They asked him if the universe talked to him, and what did it sound like? Wright replied, "Listen, and you will hear." Ooh, chills, dudes. Chills! But my favorite answer of his thousands of answers. Yes, thousands. Did I forget to mention that part? This communication went on for years, and the Johns got thousands of communications. Seems like the longest of games to play, all for a prank. When they asked, "Will you be reborn and live again as flesh and blood?" Wright said, "Anything is possible." Anything is possible. I love that. That is all for today's Spotlight. Join me for a final note. I know a lot of folks are gonna come back to this whole thing being a fabrication, and that's fine. I mean, yeah, have you seen the original photo? I'll throw it back up on screen. It looks nuts. There's no denying it does. But in learning about Wright and so much more of his communications throughout the years, I kind of got more of a sense of personality as the communications became more honed in, elaborate, meaningful. I got the sense that Wright has a bit of a spunky side to him. Some of the answers over the years have been quite pointed. Some have been quite dark. A lot have been brutally honest, I personally think, to the point of being funny. There is a sincerity to Wright, but also a little bit of a sense of humor. I believe if Wright is a real, separate, intelligent entity, not a result of psychokinesis, not a result of one of the most elaborate hoaxes that this would have to be, I think he portrayed himself that way on purpose. He either needed there to be no confusion as to what Huckert had just captured on film, or he just thought it was funny. I'm kind of keen on the second option. You know, I was thinking about this story, just going over the events in my head, and at first I was like, okay, if I'm putting my skeptical goggles on, first thing that would stand out to me that this isn't a genuine story would be that, like Peter James said, I've never heard of another instance of a ghost portraying itself in this way. In literal, smoky writing, in direct answers to questions asked, on film. But then I stumbled across the skull experiments There were a lot more examples of communications and just strange paranormal occurrences taking place over the course of that 5-year-long investigation. But I do recall, on a number of occasions, the participants did actually receive communications on film, writing, and symbols. It was different, of course. It was like film reel film, but still, it's a previous similar example we could look to. And then I was reminded of another story I know of and believe is genuine, of spirit communication in a very unique, very literal, very directed format. And I've never heard of another story of spirit communication quite like it. My recent guest, Brandy Anderson, and her family began receiving communication from her deceased grandmother via words being typed into the search bar of their smart TV. Started years ago, still ongoing today. This communication started out with a lot of questions on their end, too. It began pretty basic, with just a word or two being typed in. It took time, Brandy learned, for her grandmother to get the hang of it, so to speak, to figure it out. Right began as a boo ghost and evolved into deep sentiments. It took time for her to get enough energy to be able to put forth whole sentences at a time. Right started with messy, scrawled English and evolved to fuller thoughts, sometimes in Latin. It took time for Brandy's grandmother to communicate hard-to-understand concepts of the other side, reincarnation, God, angels, dying, but she did. Her communications and descriptions developed and evolved, became more sophisticated over the years, much like Wright. It's a different mode of communication, but a lot of aspects remain the same. I see a pattern. So, in my mind, Wright's story doesn't stand alone, after all. And being someone who believes I have personally experienced very direct, unique communication with a deceased family member that is also very unique to me, I imagine this might be the case for others across the board. Isn't all spirit communication super unique? Or do we all turn on the radio hoping for sweet Caroline? Do we all find a blue feather and it means something? No. We all would have different experiences because the spirit putting forth the communication is doing so in the most direct and impactful way they possibly can, in ways they are able to, but more importantly, ways in which, hopefully, we will actually take notice. Thank you guys for catching this one. Please follow the show on social and YouTube at Paranorm Girl Pod. If you enjoyed this one, please leave a rating and review wherever you listen. This helps me to grow the show by reaching brand new eyes and ears. Thank you so much to everyone who has done so. If you would like to show support in another really important way, recommend it to a friend you think would enjoy it as much as you do. I always check out shows recommended to me by my pals. I've found some of my own personal favorites in this way. That is a wrap for today. I hope you guys have a fabulous rest of your week. Until next time, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.
Attention, everyone! Wayfair's Black Friday preview sale is here early! Right now, score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Shift in time for the holidays. Shop early Black Friday deals now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home. Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
I've been able to live my normal lifestyle, and I've lost 20 pounds already. Changed my life.
I wasn't expecting it to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.